This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. Every Friday at 9:30 a.m., this show introduces KKFI listeners to scholars, journalists, policy analysts, and activists who can help us better understand the search for peace and justice in Israel-Palestine. I am Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's show. With tensions heightened in the Middle East after last week's assassination of a leading Iranian nuclear scientist, this week's program focuses on relations between the United States, Iran, and Israel. My first guest is Trita Parsi, an expert on Iran and the vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Later in the program, I talk to Barbara Slavin, a journalist and director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. But first, the headline news. Three Israeli human rights groups have issued a report calling the Israeli military's widespread practice of raiding Palestinian homes late at night dehumanizing. The three organizations, Breaking the Silence, Yesh Din, and Physicians for Human Rights, found that the home invasions are highly arbitrary, usually done without paperwork, and take a severe toll on individuals, families, and the wider Palestinian society. The report, which includes testimonies of soldiers, doctors, and Palestinian families, notes that on average, Israeli troops enter Palestinian homes more than 250 times every month to conduct arrests, but also for other purposes, including mapping houses, to use roofs for observation posts, or to search for money, weapons, or intelligence. Soldiers interviewed for the report said they believed an important function of many raids was to intimidate, claim denied by the Israeli military. Dr. Jumana Milhelm, a psychologist who works with Physicians for Human Rights, is quoted as saying, "What comes to my mind is that the process involves the dehumanization of a whole society." The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development issued a report last week on the Israeli blockade of the Gaza Strip. That blockade has been in effect since 2007. The report concluded that from 2007 to 2018, the blockade had cost the 2 million people living in Gaza $16.7 billion. The report found that in 2020, the people of Gaza experienced the world's highest unemployment rate, with more than half of the people living in poverty. The Gaza Strip is without a proper sewage system and is experiencing major environmental deterioration. Since the imposition of the blockade in 2007, Israel tightly controls what goes in and out of the Gaza Strip, restricting 117 categories of civilian goods because of possible dual military use. They include spare parts, construction materials, appliances, fertilizers, medical equipment, metals, pipes, water pumps, and many other items requiring special approval. My guest today is Trita Parsi, a Middle East foreign policy analyst and expert on Iran. He's the founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council and now serves as executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His books include Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States, and more recently, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita Parsi, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
A week ago, on November 27th, Iran's top nuclear scientist was assassinated. The Iranian government is accusing Israel of perpetrating the murder. Few people seem to doubt that Israel is responsible for the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Is there any doubt of this in your mind, or that the United States knew of the plan to kill him and approved or possibly even collaborated on the plan?
Well, I think we have to first recognize that while the Israeli government has denied it publicly, Israeli officials have confirmed to the New York Times that Israel was behind it and any doubt, as long as one trusts that the New York Times is not lying when it says that the Israeli officials have stated this to the paper. I think there's one question as to whether this could have happened without Donald Trump's knowing, another question as to whether it was with U.S. involvement or help. And then there's a third question that I will get to in a second. First of all, I think it's extremely unlikely that it was done without the U.S.'s knowing about this, mindful of the fact that this does potentially put U.S. assets at risk. Secondly, mindful of the extensive activity that was taking place right before this, with Pompeo visiting with Netanyahu, as well as doing a tour of some of the GCC countries that are in line and in favor of a much more belligerent approach towards Iran and who have been coordinating matters with Israel, as well as the trip of Elliot Abrams to the same countries, it also seems quite unlikely that this did not have some tacit support and help from the United States. It is noteworthy that the U.S. has been moving more military assets to the region just in the last week and even announced that it was doing so. The third question is this. If Netanyahu felt that he had a green light from Trump from doing this, what was his assessment of Biden's approach to it? I believe that Netanyahu probably calculated that President-elect Biden would not have the political will and the backbone to impose a cost on Netanyahu for doing this, mindful of the fact that the purpose of doing this is to sabotage any prospects of diplomacy between Biden and the Iranians. And this is, in that case, a perception that only Biden can change. If Biden does not want the Israelis to do these things in order to undermine Biden's foreign policy, then Biden needs to address that.
This is not the first time Israel is thought to be responsible for the death of Iranian nuclear scientists. Four scientists were killed in the period 2010 to 2012.
Well, part of the reason why so many eyes have been turning towards Israel is because it's the only country outside of the United States that has the capacity, has the history, and has the motivation to do so. There simply is not a long list. It's only the United States and Israel that really would qualify of meeting all of those different criteria.
You're an expert on the U.S.-Israel-Iran relationship. Talk to us, if you would, about that relationship and what fuels it. Is the animosity on the part of Israel and the United States somewhat spurious? It's my understanding that many people in Israel's defense establishment do not regard Iran as the threat Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu makes it out to be. Does he enlarge Iran's threat to boost his image and popularity with the Israeli public? Is the same thing true here, that U.S. politicians like to be seen as anti-Iran because they feel it plays well with the pro-Israel lobby?
It's a complex relationship with a deep history, but right now, I think the most important aspects of it is that the Israelis under Netanyahu are far more concerned about the United States and Iran reducing their tensions and U.S.-Iran relations moving in a positive trajectory than they are of any likelihood of the Iranians getting a nuclear weapon and using a nuclear weapon. The Israelis know very well the Iranians are very far away from having a nuclear weapon. And even if they had one, it would be completely suicidal for them to use it against Israel. What they're worried about is that the balance of power in the region will shift, that when Iran comes out of its economic isolation as a result of U.S.-Iran relations improving. So the real threat is not an Iranian nuclear weapon. They can manage that. They know also that it's highly exaggerated. The real threat is that the United States and Iran resolve their tensions, whereas Israel will continue to have its own tensions with Iran. This is why the Israelis have been so adamant to undermine the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, and so adamant about making sure that Biden does not try to revive the JCPOA. And that is exactly what they seem to have been calculating behind this assassination.
Just to clarify for listeners, the JCPOA stands for the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the formal name for the nuclear deal reached between Iran and the five permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany and the European Union. The nuclear agreement was signed in 2015 under President Obama. President Trump withdrew the United States from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed stringent sanctions on Iran. Iran continued to abide by the agreement, but a year later, after it had not received any of the promised sanctions relief, it began taking small countermeasures. I want to ask you about Iran's support for Hezbollah and Hamas and the Palestinian cause. Years ago, Iran and Israel had more positive relations, and that was true even during the first years of the Islamic Republic, which took power after the Iranian Revolution in 1979. How much does Iranian support for the Palestinian cause engender Israeli hostility?
Yes, the Iranians and the Israelis had good relations back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, which was mainly driven by geopolitical concerns. They faced common threats back then, powerful Arab countries such as Iraq under Saddam Hussein or Egypt under Nasser, as well as the Soviet Union. What we're seeing now since the mid-1990s or early 1990s is a completely different geopolitical reality, one in which the Iranians and the Israelis view each other as rivals for dominance and strategic significance in the region. So these concerns about Iran's support for Palestinian organizations, Hezbollah, are not in any way, shape, or form unimportant, but even during periods in which the Iranians were supporting those groups, the Iranians and the Israelis managed to find ways to work with each other, as they did in the 1980s, because of the Israeli support for Iran against Saddam Hussein. So I think it's a little bit simplistic to only look at it from the prism that, well, the Iranians are supporting Hezbollah, so the Israelis are justified in whatever they're doing. It has a much deeper geopolitical root to this, one in which at this point, even if the Iranians were to seek some form of reconciliation with the Israelis, I don't believe that that would be sufficient, because the Israelis do not want to see any country in the region or any combination of countries in the region having the power of being able to challenge Israel's military domination. And whereas that may be something that the Israelis can impose on a state like the UAE or on Jordan, that is not something that I think any Iranian government, whether this government, the Shah's government, or hopefully a future democratic government, is likely to accept.
Now, with the Abraham Accords between the UAE and Israel and Bahrain and Israel, Arab countries seem to be abandoning the Palestinians. How significant is Iranian support to the Palestinians now?
Well, the Iranians have, their support for the Palestinian cause have tended to be much more rhetorical than practical. At the end of the day, the Iranians have not had particularly good relations with the main Palestinian faction, which is Fatah, and its support has primarily been to Islamic Jihad and to Hamas. And it's also been not particularly good at maneuvering Palestinian politics and has its own tensions with Hamas based on Hamas's proximity to the Muslim Brotherhood and their support for the opposition in Syria, whereas Iran has been supporting Assad. So it's a complicated picture, but I think the moves by the UAE, Bahrain, and potentially Saudi Arabia to forego the idea of recognition for recognition, and the Arab position has been that if the Israelis recognize a Palestinian state, the Arab states will recognize Israel. Now they moved away from recognition to recognition to recognition for F-35s. The UAE are recognizing the Israeli states, normalizing relations, and completely foregoing any opposition to occupation and annexation in return for the purchase of American weaponry such as F-35s, which the UAE are primarily doing because it's a way for them to tie the United States to UAE security rather than actually them thinking that they will be really using those F-35s. In that new context, the few countries that remain steadfast in not succumbing to Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory are becoming fewer and in that sense also a little bit more important. Whether they can do much about it, et cetera, of course, remains to be seen. Many of them are faced with their own tremendous difficulties, and in the past have also shown to use the Palestinian cause a little bit more to advance their own interests and their own political ambitions rather than actually helping the Palestinians.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Trita Parsi, a Middle East foreign policy expert, about relations between the United States, Israel, and Iran. The hostage crisis more than 40 years ago now created ill will between the new Islamic Republic of Iran that came to power and the United States. How much of the ill will towards Iran in this country derives from that long ago episode? What accounts for the continuing animosity towards Iran here?
Well, I think first we have to recognize that there is a basis for the animosity in the first place. There is, however, not, in my view, a basis for not overcoming it. And the Obama administration proved that it is possible to overcome it through diplomacy because the JCPOA took a very major step in that direction. Unfortunately, that was halted by Trump and by pressure from Israel and some of the Arab countries who do not want to see an improvement. Inside the United States, there's a combination of elements and factors that makes the U.S. hesitant, if not opposed to the idea of losing Iran as an enemy. You have, on the one hand, pro-Israel elements that are very sympathetic to Netanyahu and the Likud perspective, but you also have, very importantly, evangelical Christians who have taken a far more pro-Netanyahu perspective on a lot of these different matters than even some of the pro-Israeli groups have otherwise. I mean, you have Jewish American groups that are quite opposed to what Netanyahu is doing and extremely supportive of the JCPOA. I'm not aware of any evangelical groups that have taken such a position. But you also have elements in the military who, because of their experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, are not necessarily looking at this from a strategic perspective, but are looking at it from the perspective of seeking vengeance and have a very bad experience with Iran as a result of what was taking place in Iraq and Afghanistan. You have also others who have, frankly, nothing more than an imperialistic perspective, who wants to see the United States dominate the Middle East militarily. And the biggest obstacle to an American military hegemony in the Middle East is the opposition coming from Iran. And as a result, they're pushing for a very aggressive posture vis-a-vis Iran. I would put John Bolton, for instance, in that category. So there are quite a few different elements. I do believe, however, that without the active campaign by the Israeli government and some of the Arab states to constantly keep alive the U.S.-Iran enmity, many of those other factors would be much more easier to overcome.
You mentioned the hostility of Arab countries in the Middle East towards Iran. What is that all about?
From the perspective of countries such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and I think this is really important for the American public to understand, it is not necessarily just an enmity with Iran. There certainly is one. There's a tremendous amount of suspicion. There's a sectarian component to it as well. But what is really critical for them is that they don't want to see the United States leave the Middle East. As long as the United States is there with 60-plus troops and 19-plus bases, they feel that they can live safely under an American security umbrella. The problem for them, of course, is that the American public wants to leave the Middle East. The American public does not want to have this number of troops there, and it wants to end the endless wars. If that were to happen, these countries that are not really capable of fending for themselves would have to adjust their position vis-a-vis Iran, and they want to avoid doing that. And as long as they can keep the United States committed to the Middle East by stoking U.S.-Iran tensions, by exaggerating the threat from Iran, they believe that they are advancing their own security by ensuring that the United States remains trapped in the Middle East.
Most experts seem to think that Iran will have to respond to the assassination of its top nuclear scientist. How do you think it will respond, and what kind of calculations do you think it will make in deciding its response?
There's people in Iran within the government that view this as a trap and do not want to walk into the trap and believe that Netanyahu wants the Iranians to respond so that he can get his war. There are elements in Iran who argue that as long as Iran doesn't respond, and Iran has not responded to a lot of other provocations and attacks, it will only mean that the Israelis will continue to attack and assassinate scientists in Iran and others. And as a result, there is a necessity for Iran to prevent future attacks by responding harshly to this one. That debate has not come to a conclusion yet. And I think that the first group just wants to wait until Biden is in office, and then perhaps a need for a response may not be as necessary in their perspective. So we don't know yet exactly how they will respond. And I think the vast majority of countries hope that the Iranians show restraint. Challenge, though, is that if countries in the world do not condemn this and really challenge and single out Israel, call out Israel for having done this, I fear that the argument that will be winning in Iran may be the one that seeks a much stronger retaliation immediately.
My final question for you: what's the biggest misunderstanding the American public has about Iran and the U.S. relationship with it?
I think the first misunderstanding is that this is some form of ideological battle that the United States has a big stake in. It is not. It is a geopolitical battle, and the United States is unnecessarily entangled in it. It does not serve its interests to be a belligerent in this fight. This is, at this stage, really a fabricated crisis, because if we had just stuck to the nuclear deal, we would be well on our way to resolve a bunch of other problems diplomatically. That was sabotaged by the Trump administration, by the Israeli government, and by a few Arab countries. I mean, we're really not just talking about the UAE and Saudi Arabia. Many of the other Arab countries do not want to see a conflict, are very much opposed to what the Saudis and the UAE are doing, and have come out and stated their desire for diplomatic solutions rather than this confrontational path that the Saudis and the UAE and Israel has preferred.
I've been speaking to Middle East expert Trita Parsi. He's the author of several books about Iranian-U.S. relations and is the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Trita Parsi, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Joining us now is journalist and Middle East policy expert Barbara Slavin. She's the director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Washington think tank, the Atlantic Council, and is Washington correspondent for the news website Al Monitor. Barbara, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
I'm wondering if you could address the nuclear hypocrisy of the situation in which Israel, a country that does have nuclear weapons, is assassinating the nuclear scientists of a country that does not have nuclear weapons, is part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Israel is not, and in 2015 agreed to major cutbacks in its civilian nuclear program. It seems crazy.
This is a dysfunctional relationship, and it has been for a very long time, which is not to excuse what Israel did. The fact that Iran agreed to put curbs on its nuclear program, the fact that Fakhrizadeh, the man that was assassinated, that his weapons program was essentially shut down almost 20 years ago, these are all important factors. But clearly, the Israeli government is taking advantage of the last days of the Trump administration to do as much damage as it can to Iran's nuclear infrastructure and military infrastructure in general.
So far, the strongest criticism I've heard of Israel's action is from former CIA Director John Brennan, who called it criminal and highly reckless, an act of state-sponsored terrorism, and got into a Twitter feud with Senator Ted Cruz about it. You wrote an op-ed for the New York Times this past weekend in which you called for other countries to strongly condemn Israel's assassination. How do you think other countries' responses might affect Iran's choice of action in responding to last week's assassination?
We've seen one statement come out from the European Union, which was tough. I'd like to see the British, French, and Germans, the so-called E3, also come out and condemn this wholeheartedly. I think that this gives Iran cover not to retaliate in a way that'll just make things even worse. I mean, we still have 50 days of Trump and a complete blank check to Bibi to do what he wants against Iran. So we have to try to keep this from getting even worse. And certainly statements like the one the EU put out, that helps.
I'm curious why the lame duck Trump administration seems so bent on punishing Iran, imposing new sanctions after the election and taking a very belligerent stance. What's it all about?
Oh boy, domestic politics has a lot to do with it. I mean, Trump promised Christian evangelicals and Sheldon Adelson that he would dump the Iran deal, that he would blow it up. And he did. He tried to, certainly. I think it's also frustration that his brilliant diplomacy didn't result in a new and better deal or any positive change in Iranian policies. I mean, all it did was make 80 million people more miserable than they already are. I just tweeted, in fact, that Trump was that Hassan Rouhani wouldn't take his phone call in the summer of 2019 when both of them were at the United Nations General Assembly. Who knows? I mean, with Trump, he always doubles down on failed policies. If they don't work, he just keeps pushing them, and they don't work.
Do you think Donald Trump is steering this policy or Secretary of State Mike Pompeo?
I think Pompeo is more important in this because Pompeo wants to be president. Assuming Trump will step aside in 2024 and let anybody else run on the Republican side, Pompeo is an evangelical Christian, and his whole hope for political future rests on his support from people who are looking for Israel to become even more powerful so it can be destroyed when Jesus Christ comes back to earth. I mean, that is it, right?
You mentioned these sanctions are making 80 million people in Iran more miserable. I know you've been to Iran. I don't know if you've been there recently, but what are you either seeing or hearing about how those sanctions are affecting the economy and ordinary Iranians' lives?
First off, their currency has collapsed. So that means that it takes many more of their rials to buy anything. Inflation is now terrible. It had been curbed when Hassan Rouhani became president. People are not able to afford meat. very often, if at all. Even medicine is scarce now, despite the fact that that's supposed to be exempted from sanctions. Trump has sanctioned pretty much every Iranian bank. So even if Western companies want to sell stuff to Iran, there's no way for them to get paid. It is cruel and counterproductive. It has not changed Iranian policies one whit. In fact, it's made Iran more aggressive in some areas, but it has made a lot of ordinary people suffer.
And how do you think the incoming Biden administration is going to respond to this challenge that Israel has presented it with?
It depends on whether there's, you know, still a nuclear deal to return to. I hope there will be. But look at the people in the Biden administration. Tony Blinken, the incoming Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, both have negotiated with Iran. Jake Sullivan was part of the first back-channel talks with the Iranians in 2012 in Oman. They have a lot of experience in this area. Trump left through executive order, and the sanctions have all been imposed through executive orders, and they can be relieved through executive orders.
Last question, because we really don't have many minutes. How do you think this attack, the attacks on Iran, how might they affect the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, if at all?
The Iranians have to wake up and recognize the fact that the Palestinian issue has been marginalized to a great extent in the Middle East. I don't think that's going to change that much under Biden. I mean, we'll have a relationship with Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority again. But the fact that the Emiratis and the Bahrainis and the Sudanese, you know, have recognized Israel, and that the Saudis have de facto recognized Israel, means that Iran looks a little odd as a non-Arab state out there advocating for the Palestinians. Ideally, we see diplomatic efforts to contain this and, you know, support the Palestinians, but in a way that's not going to aggravate the situation, and the Iranians start toning down their rhetoric and actions as well. But that's going to take real hard diplomatic work, not just from the United States, but from the Europeans and from regional countries, you know, that are going to have to realize that they have to talk to Iran, not just contain it.
Barbara Slavin, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Sure.
I've been talking to Barbara Slavin. She's a journalist and the director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. The show airs weekly on Fridays at 9:30 a.m. You can also listen to the show on KKFI's website, kkfi.org.